I just recommend to people, you know, when you read the Bible and delight in its truth the way you delight in the relationship with the God it's revealing. You know, so when I would read Genesis in the children's Bible with my kids, it, you know, we'd think about, oh, isn't it amazing that God created all these beautiful things? Let's go look at something beautiful. Isn't it amazing that God created all this food that tastes so good? Let's, you know, let's really enjoy this juicy grape. And just trying to say, like, how do we teach our kids to be worshipers and to be grateful people who dwell in a creation that's good? Like, that's the kind of instruction I think that their souls need in that kind of concrete phase that they're in. And then later, you know, as they start asking questions about other things, you can bring up the more detailed things. My name is Christy Hemphill. I work for SIL, which is an organization that does language development and assists local teams in the translation of scriptures.
Welcome to Language of God. I'm Jim Stump. Christy Hemphill's well known to the inner circle of BioLogos. She plays an integral role in moderating the BioLogos Forum, and she's part of the team working on Integrate, a biology curriculum supplement. We'll talk about both those roles in the interview, but we start by hearing about Christy's day job, which is as a professional linguist working on a Bible translation living in the remote hills of Mexico while working out the intricacies of culture and language there. Speaking across a language and cultural divide is one thing, but Christy's work on Integrate and her years homeschooling her children has also given her insight into how to speak to children about tricky theological issues. For that part of the conversation, we bring our producer Colin to the microphone for some immediate application. Colin has young children himself, and he talks to Christy about walking the thin line between simplicity and complexity when answering a child's questions about origins, the Bible, and the nature of God. This is a fun one. Let's get to the conversation. Well, hi, Christy. We're very glad to be talking to you in this format. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jim. It's fun to talk to you outside of a Google Doc. I feel like we don't get to hear each other's voices very often.
Yeah, so you have put in a lot of hours on behalf of BioLogos, and those are primarily behind the scenes on Google Docs and such, but we thought it would be fun to bring you out here in, do you say in front of the scenes? Does that metaphor still work?
On the stage, maybe?
You're here on the stage. We'll show you off a little for everybody a bit. But before we talk about your BioLogos work, I want to start with other parts of your life, your day job, as it were. So maybe give us a little autobiography. Where'd you come from? What are you interested in? What does your normal life look like?
Okay, sure. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and I had a very idyllic, functional childhood that has no interesting or dramatic stories in it other than very happy things. It's funny because my mom recently has taken some classes at Moody on spiritual formation. And so she got it in her head that I probably have these woundings from how I was raised that I should process. And so she was asking me, you know, how have you been wounded by your childhood? And I remember when I was a junior in high school, I went to visit the Art Institute of Chicago because I was thinking about attending there. I was a very competent illustrator and painter. And I realized when I was touring that I was not an artist. And this campus was full, it was the mid-90s, it was full of people in like flannel and combat boots and black lipstick who stayed up till 3 a.m. listening to indie rock and, you know, painting violent pictures about the way that the objectification of women ruined souls. And I was like, I am not an artist. I have no angst. My childhood has not prepared me to rage against anything. So I ended up instead going to the school where good Christian kids with very high GPAs and good SAT scores go, which is Wheaton College. And I listened to Jars of Clay and wrote about theology of culture and went to bed at a decent time. And
you grew up in an evangelical faith community too?
Yes, yes. I was a child of evangelicalism, you know, focus on the family on the radio, and went to summer camp and youth group, and very much, I think a lot of people are right now are feeling very scarred by that background, but I did not, like, I don't have all these negative associations with it, like some people who are pouring their troubles out on Twitter these days have. So I was homeschooled actually too, but not in the like fundy denim dress, you know, 15 children kind of way, just in a regular educational option kind of way. And I had a very positive experience being homeschooled. My mom was very, she really liked the idea of us pursuing our interests. And so, you know, I had a microscope and I had a rock collection, and we would go out and collect wildflowers and use field guides. And I read all the books in the library in the children's section. And it was a very good time for sort of just stimulating an interest in learning. And then I went to public school in sixth grade, and, that was not a negative experience either. So I had
we'll keep the story going from Wheaton then.
I go to Wheaton. I couldn't decide what to study because I really love learning and I like everything. And so I decided to pick the class that was easiest for me to be my major, which was French. And so I was a French major. It's been completely useless to me in life, but I enjoy studying and reading
useless.
French literature.
That's not what a good liberal arts education is supposed to be, is all about utility, right?
The liberal arts education was wonderful. The French major was just pure enrichment. I can recite some Baudelaire poetry for you if you'd like. But my advisor told me, you're not going to be able to really do much with a French major, so you should pick up a Spanish minor. And I was also an education major. And so I did. And the Spanish minor has come in very useful in life. And ended up being a teacher after I got married out of college, graduated first, then got married. And then I taught in an inner city high school for a little while, Spanish, hated that. And so I went and got a master's degree in teaching English as a second language, which is an applied linguistics degree. And I loved linguistics. And so that's kind of how I got on the linguistics track in life. It wasn't really in my undergrad. It was in grad school.
And you now live full-time, at least in Mexico, doing that sort of work. So how did that come
about? Yes. Well, I met my husband at Wheaton, and Wheaton has these missions conferences where they bring in representatives from all these different organizations and talk about what's going on around the world. And he was a Spanish major. And so we were both liked languages, and we were, you know, he was a Bible major too. And so he'd studied some Greek, and we weren't dating at the time, but we ended up both going to this session where there was this Wycliffe translator who was working with a community that lived in Chicago. There were enough members of this community in a single apartment complex that he was working with them to produce a Bible, a New Testament translation, because the country they were from, you weren't allowed to go to very easily. And so we both ended up staying after the like presentation and kind of picking this guy's brain. And he was so fascinating. And I think I got put on the list of girls to maybe ask out sometime in the future because of that conversation.
He had a list?
Yes, yes. Well, that's another story.
And how'd you end up in Mexico? I think that's what I asked earlier, but we got a little sidetracked there.
Yeah, well, we got married, and we were interested in doing Bible translation, but my husband needed to serve 4 years in the Army to pay for college. And I'm kind of hardcore in some ways. Like, I can sleep wherever and I will eat, you know, whatever you put in front of me. But I knew myself that, like, I wasn't going to be having babies in the jungle and washing their diapers in a river. And I just wasn't that hardcore. I wanted to be by my mom and have grocery store nearby. And so I said, look, if we're going to like go off on some kind of world adventure, I want to like crank out the babies first. And then we can do it when they're like out of diapers. And so that was sort of our deal. So when he got out of the Army, I had 3 children in 3.5 years. Yeesh. And then when the youngest was about 2, we're like, okay, like, are we doing this? Are we going to, like sell our house and move to another country? And we decided it was kind of like, we were either going to do it now or we weren't going to do it. So we joined Wycliffe and we went to Dallas to get some training. You have to get a master's degree in Bible translation. So we did the first part of that. And then we went down to Mexico. My church had a focus on Mexico at the time, which is what pushed us in that direction. And we both spoke Spanish. So that was one less step we would have to do is learn the national language. So it just kind of seemed like it made sense. So we headed there in 2012. And we work in Guerrero, which is in southern Mexico. And a lot of people don't understand how, like, why would many Mexicans need a Bible translation? Obviously, there's plenty of translations in Spanish. And what people forget is that Mexico is a colonial country, just like the United States. And when the Spanish came over from Europe, there were already many, many cultures and people groups living in the territory that they conquered. So we work with an indigenous community. We work with four different translations that are in related varieties of a language family called Mepa. And they have a team of 10 translators that are working on these New Testaments to provide their community with the scriptures in their own language. Not everyone is fluent in Spanish. Many people are not, like, reading in Spanish is difficult for them. So it's something that is needed. And there's been a team there working on it for like several decades, and we're sort of the B team helping the four teams finish up. So hopefully in the next 5 years or so, at least a couple of them will be done and ready to publish and be used in the churches. And we're excited about that.
So I lived, my wife and I lived in West Africa for a year, and on the hilltop right next to us was a translating team that was working on an Old Testament translation for the language of Karanko, if I remember correctly. But I remember talking to them about some of the issues of translating into these languages that often have very different contexts and even different words that can't really be translated. For example, I remember them talking about the verse in Isaiah that says, though your sins are as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. There is no word for snow. And I think they ended up saying something like as white as pounded yams or something like that, right? Are there any interesting sorts of stories like that for the translation you're working in that are particular challenges of communicating these concepts into the language?
Oh, yeah. It comes up all the time and things you wouldn't think of. The first book we worked on was Jonah. And so we live in very, very steep mountains. When it rains, all the water like fills up the arroyos and runs down the mountain. So there's no standing water. There's no rivers. There's no lakes. And so there's no word for boat. So No word for boat. And some people travel, it's not like they never get out, but a lot of people have never been very far from where they grew up. And so they've never even seen a large body of water. They've seen puddles and rushing streams down the mountain. So this was like really difficult, and they didn't want to, there's a word in Spanish, no barco, and they have a pronunciation in Mepa, so barco. And they were like, well, just use the Spanish word, borrowed into your language. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to use like an authentic phrase from their own language. And so they ended up saying something like the large piece of wood that floats on the face of the water is the word for boat. But if you look at how many times the word boat or ship gets translated, then there's actually several different words. He took a boat to one place and then he took a ship somewhere else. And so they're like, so then they have the extra big boat.
That's a really big piece of wood.
The extra big piece of wood that floats on the face of the water. So there's things like that. Things like wine. There are no grapes. Most people have never seen grapes. They don't drink wine. They drink beer and mezcal. That's their concept of alcohol. And so translating something like wine, you can't even say grape juice because there's no word for grapes. So you do come across things. And then people don't realize just how very, very different languages are. I think people get into, you know, using different tools to kind of compare English and Greek and the New Testament, but Greek is an Indo-European language, as is English. So even though it feels very different, like we still have very similar conceptual frames. System,
yeah.
We're Western civilization. We're like, we've inherited a lot of Greek patterns of thought. Whereas in some of these Mesoamerican languages, like there's very, very few abstract nouns, which makes Paul very difficult. Mm. And you have just some overlaps in the language that don't work because they phrase their thoughts in very different constructions. And so that's kind of interesting to look at the back translation and see how it turned out.
Yeah. So there's sometimes this distinction that's made between translations and paraphrases of scripture, right? The NIV or the NRSV versus the Living Bible or the Message. Is that a helpful distinction, or does that start to break down in these kinds of situations, or where's the line between those?
Well, I think the American, the Bible consumer public is very convinced that like literal translations are a feature, and the community of translators would actually think that's bonkers. And so there's this idea kind of in common thinking that the closer you are to the original text, like the more words you can get to match up, the better of a translation it is. It's not really true, because words are just labels we put on our concepts, and no concepts are exactly the same from one culture to another culture, from one, you know, physical location to another physical location. And so you can't just find equivalent labels in other languages because they trigger different concepts, even if they are similar. So, when we're talking about translation, we're trying to say, okay, what is the meaning that the original text communicates? And then how do we help people construct that same meaning or close meaning in their own language? And different translations have different philosophies about how, like you mentioned, the changing the snow to pounded yams, like how domesticating, we call it, you're going to be to communicate the meaning, or how much you're going to leave the text to be a foreign text that kind of needs some help to be understood. So, different people have different perspectives on what you should do. We try to work with what the community wants. So some communities want the scripture translation to be very close to a prestige, like in Mexico, the Reina Valera is sort of like the KJV is in English. It's sort of a prestige historical translation that's used in many, many churches. And so they don't want their indigenous language translations to be too far off from what they understand the Reina Valera to be communicating. So, translation as a whole, I feel like in my life, it really made me hold a lot more loosely to some of the things I believed about like what the Bible does and what we can expect of it, because you just realize how limiting our languages and our cultures are in what we can understand from someone else.
Yeah, we'll get to talking a bit about that in just a minute. Let's finish up this section of your work and life in the remote hills of Mexico with what are the biggest challenges you face in your life and work there, and what are the most rewarding parts of that work and life?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a picture for this. So if you go to YouTube and you type in, it's like cockatoo meows like a cat, you get this video. It's got 11 million views, and it's this cockatoo. He sounds exactly like a cat, and there's maybe three kittens, and the cockatoo goes up to the kittens and like meows in their faces, and the cats don't know what to do with this. And they just kind of like back away slowly, or they run away, or they just stare at the cockatoo. And I feel like this is a metaphor for my life, that I am trying so hard to meow in so many different contexts with cats, and I am a cockatoo. And So living cross-culturally, like that's what it's like. You try to fit in, you try to speak the way the people around you speak, but you're always, you know, have feathers and not fur. And I felt that way when I was teaching in the inner city. I felt that way when I, like as a homeschooler, as a not super conservative Christian in very conservative Christian homeschooling missionary communities, I often feel like a cockatoo among cats. Even on Biologos, when I, you know, come sit at the science table, my liberal arts self, I'm like, oh, I can speak science with you people.
Your French major doesn't go very far.
Exactly. But I'm like, I'm going to try. I'm going to meow at you guys. And someday you're going to accept me as one of your own. So
that's the challenging part. What's the rewarding part?
Yeah, the rewarding part is I feel like I have a story for my life where I've done some hard things that matter, and I'm not going to look back and feel like I, you know, didn't accept an adventure or didn't, you know, step out of my suburban comfort zone. Like I've done it. I've made some efforts to kind of, well, I guess in the talk of day, like lay down my privilege and be an advocate and a ally of people who are marginalized, who are just disadvantaged in a lot of ways. And I've done what I can to try to help with that in ways that I think are just and righteous. And so I feel validated when I look at the last 10 years of I look at the ceiling sometimes when I'm sleeping in our house in Soquitlan, which is the mountains, and it's, you know, it's just bare concrete and there's spiders. And sometimes I just lay in bed and I'm like, what am I doing here? Like, I am not a cat. And I have to kind of come back to, like, I really feel like I was obedient to what I was called to. And I really feel like I have, like, learned and grown in the ways that I was supposed to learn and grow through the various stretching experiences of it all.
Good. Okay, so what's the connection then between your work and life in these remote hills in Mexico and your involvement with Biologos? And I mean this connection both in terms of conceptually in your mind that it made sense for you to bring these two worlds together, but then also in terms of the actual things that how did it actually happen that you got involved with us?
Right. Well, a lot of people think it's not related at all. They're like, you're in missions and Biologos deals with science. And that's true, but Biologos also deals with the Bible a lot. And so I started reading white papers on Biologos back when the website was launched because
that
I was
you
very...
just stumbled upon that you...
I read about it in Christianity Today. There was a little blurb that, you know, Francis Collins' organization is starting this website. And I went to it and I downloaded papers and I had them on my Kindle and I would read them, you know, in waiting rooms and stuff. And the things I was interested in were about how does God speak through human words and how do we make meaning out of this ancient text and how does the ancient Near Eastern culture inform our understanding and how do we like impose all of our own, you know, modern Western ideas onto a text when it's not really warranted. And these are the exact same questions that we ask in as translators when we're trying to contextualize the Bible in a minority culture and help people understand the meaning to the ancient audience so that they can communicate the meaning to their audience. And so they're very much the same kinds of questions I'd been thinking about in my coursework and in my work. And so it wasn't a huge disconnect. And then the reason I got involved was when we first were in Mexico, we did not have internet in our home. And so And it was very isolating. I mean, my husband was the only like English speaker I would interact with who was an adult and, you know, for weeks at a time sometimes. And I am a delightful person in small doses, but we live and work very closely and spend a lot of time together. And so you know, you need other people. And I also, my Myers-Briggs personality type is debater. So I find it very entertaining to argue about things. And that is not so good for a marriage if you only have one person. And so I at one point I got this like stick that you would stick in the USB that would give you like a couple hours of internet access. And one of the, I couldn't get Facebook to load on it because the internet was so bad. And I could barely download my emails, but for some reason the BioLogos forum and the homeschool forums, because they're like low, I don't know, it was very text-based. It seemed to like, you know, if I clicked refresh enough times, I could get them to come up. So I had been on the forum like way, way back. I checked out. It was like September 2014 because your wife, Chris, asked me to participate in a book club when I was in a place where I had good internet. So then I left and came back to where I lived, where I had no internet. And I was just like isolated. I needed somebody to talk to besides my husband, who was exhausted by me. And I could get the forum to come up. And so I would, you know, have my little theological discussions with whatever people were hanging out there. And it was kind of a good outlet for me. And then at some point, Brad Kramer, who was running the forum, he's like, how about I just give you some moderator buttons and you can help me out with this? Mm-hmm. And so I ended up being a moderator. And then, you know, it just kind of, I never left. I looked it up. I now have 66 days worth of reading forum topics.
That's how much of your life you spent on there.
Hmm. Yes.
So sometimes on the mid-roll for these podcast episodes, we have somebody tell all our listeners about the BioLogos forum. How do you describe what the forum is when, say, one of your friends or family members finds out that you've spent 60 days of your life as a forum moderator, and they ask, what is that exactly?
Yes, well, it's like a weird cross between like social media and classes is how I feel. So you have, because of the software is far better than like Facebook or Twitter for actually having an intelligent conversation with like back and forth where you interact with what people say. So you have very high level discussions going on. And the people who tend to participate are just much more knowledgeable in general. I mean, we always have some interesting characters show up, but in general, the people who participate are very well-read, people with expertise in certain areas. And so I just found the conversations to be like the best place on the internet to have a good discussion about something I was thinking about. And I am an external processor, which means I don't really always know what I think or feel about something until I explain it to somebody. So it was just very helpful for me, even just in my own spiritual life and my own like thought development, to have people to converse with about some really deep things, some really, I mean, sometimes very academic kind of things to bounce off. Like, I'm reading this book and, you know, what do you think about this idea? And so that's sort of what drew me in. And most of the people who know me, you know, they get it and they understand that they would rather have the people on the forum be listening to all my deep brain wanderings than have to suffer through it themselves. So they're happy to send me off there.
So when I started at BioLogos back in 2013 as the content editor, the forum was under my jurisdiction. And about the first significant decision I made was to end it. So I don't know if you were around by then, but I wrote this blog post saying we're going to discontinue the forum in a week because it was dominated by just this handful of people commenting. It was too labor intensive to keep going. And I looked around these other websites. Nobody else had one of these. And you could kind of see why. And well, anyway, so I said, let's just stop. And so I put this out and was really surprised by the response from our readers, which was impassioned and unanimous in saying that I just made a colossal mistake. And after reading a bunch of those responses, 2 days later, we reversed the decision and have kept it going ever since then. Can you, with the help of you and several other people that spend a fair bit of time on there, can you give a sort of defense or an apologia for the forum, why it's a good thing for an organization like us to maintain something like that? Or
Yeah, well, it is one of the few places on the internet left that does what it does. Because, you know, NPR shut down their comment boards, Christianity Today shut down their comment boards. And part of the problem is because you actually need human beings interacting and, you know, regulating it so it doesn't become a big, you know, place where people dump spam and abuse one another. Yeah. So it is work intensive, but I feel like the value is that there just aren't that many places where you can get what it offers. There's a regular on the forum who's agnostic. He's not a Christian. And he stumbled on BioLogos. Someone had mentioned it on an atheist forum. And he came over and he's like, I am so tired of the atheist forum. It's just like full of hostile people. And so I'm going to, you know, discuss things over here. And he loves it. He's like one of our biggest evangelists for come talk over here with these kind Christians who read books and have intelligent conversations. And so I think that it's not just this kind of niche, very strange Christian who is interested only in origins and, you know, likes to argue about what the meaning of the word yom is in Genesis, whether it's literal 24 hours or like, it's not just that kind of person who's found
there are those
community.
Kind of people, to be fair, right?
There You're are right. those kind of people. But I think a lot of the people who come by kind of regularly just appreciate that it's a community of people who are thinking, you know, it's very diverse, but there's a critical mass of people who are thinking along the same lines and they can get feedback from a perspective that they trust. And like a lot of people, I think right now in this moment in evangelicalism or however evangelical adjacent you feel, if you don't want to use the label, people are kind of looking around them and saying like, who are my people? I don't feel like I fit in the way I used to, or I don't really know where my community is. The people around me don't want to talk about the things that I'm most interested in processing. And so I think the forum for a lot of people has been that safer place than their in real life communities where they can talk about things they're wondering about. They can bring up their doubts. They can kind of maybe be more honest about the questions they have and find a bunch of people who are also sort of walking that same question journey. And you know, be encouraged that it doesn't all like lead to losing your faith and, you know, throwing in the towel on everything. That like a lot of people are processing this in a healthy, constructive way that leaves them in a better place than when they started. I think that is what a lot of people enjoy being a part of.
Hi, listeners. On this podcast, we hear a lot of stories of young people who consider leaving the church because of the tensions they find between science and faith. It doesn't have to be that way. That's why we developed Integrate, a teaching resource designed for classroom teachers and home educators. It seeks to equip the next generation of Christian leaders to be faithful, informed, and gracious voices engaging with the hard questions raised by science. To learn more, just go to biologos.org/integrate. All right, back to the conversation.
Well, another of the projects you've gotten involved with at BioLogos is Integrate, the biology curriculum supplement, which is aimed primarily at homeschoolers and Christian schools. We talked to another of the Integrate people, April Cordero, back in episode 29 on the podcast. But can you give us a little update of where things stand now with that project?
Yeah, so I feel like every time I talk about it, we're always almost finished. And I think maybe this time we really are almost finished. It's been a huge project. And I just want to say, like, it is one of the things I am most proud of that I have been involved in. That this team that I've had the opportunity to work on has, that there's just the best people, the best team where everyone kind of pulled their weight and had something to offer. And I really feel like what we have, like, it's like childbirth, you know, what we have labored to bring into mm-hmm. this world is really something that I'm proud of. And we have 15 units that not all of them are available for sale, but they're coming out soon. And the idea,
some of them are now,
some of them are available now. Yes. Yep. You can find it through the BioLogos website. And the idea was, people kept asking BioLogos, you know, we have this, we see that there's this young earth kind of focused curriculum for Christian schools and homeschoolers, but where's the evolutionary creationist curriculum that we can use? Because we don't want to use this, these materials that are kind of very, very geared toward promoting young earth creationism. And so we talked through some with parents and educators, and we came to the conclusion, we don't need like a textbook of evolutionary creationism, because the science part is just science. And there are good, solid science curriculums out there. But what people wanted was a supplement to that, that would help them answer some of these faith, science, ethics, theology, philosophy questions that science raises from a solid Christian perspective, and would help them kind of bring up some of these conversations on the edge of the intersection of faith and science with their students. So we have 15 unit studies on different topics. And the goal is to bring in some of the science content, but also bring in some theology, bring in some Bible study, bring in some ethical questions that are being raised by these new technologies, new discoveries, and really give students a chance to sort of process how do we think about these things in light of our values as Christians, in light of our commitments, in light of what we believe the Bible teaches. And so it's a resource guide for parents and teachers. And I think a lot of people hear BioLogos and they think it's all about evolution and creation, and it really isn't. We have a unit on fossils, a unit on evolution, and then a unit on human evolution. But the rest of the curriculum is other things. So we talk about creation care and conservation, and things like DNA testing, and just things that maybe you haven't thought of as a faith science intersection issue. And so I really think that teachers and students, even if they aren't coming from like the BioLogos perspective, are really going to find things in the curriculum that are useful to them as they just try to equip their students to see science as a Christian vocation, to see like the importance of having Christian voices at the table as our societies are making these important decisions.
Talk a little bit about the reception of this so far, because I think one of the things we wondered about at the beginning is what kind of market would there be? Would there be enough people out there who were interested in this kind of a supplement in the Christian school and homeschooling market? Because I think lots of people have probably a caricature in their minds of what homeschoolers are like, and whether they would even listen to someone like BioLogos on a topic like that. So talk a little bit more broad about the market more broadly, the kind of people that are interested in this, maybe the motivations that people have for homeschooling or sending their kids to a Christian school, which aren't always fitting the stereotypes that we have in mind. And then just some of the early returns, what you've heard from people who have tried out some of these units or what they're finding, some of that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of ideas people have from maybe homeschoolers they know. and the demographics of who is homeschooling has changed. It's changed because people in the church and the culture have changed. So not everyone's homeschooling because they want to kind of create their own alternate culture and really shelter their children from public school. Some people are doing it because their children have anxiety issues or were being bullied in school, or, you know, with the whole pandemic, you have a whole other, set of reasons why people are pulling their kids out of school and considering homeschooling. Some school districts are just not that great for education. And so parents are like, well, what other educational options? If we can't afford private school tuition, maybe homeschooling is an option. So there are a lot of people homeschooling now, and there are a lot of resources that make it possible for parents to homeschool outside of, you know, some of these maybe more stereotypical super conservative or super hippie or whatever it is you think of.
Or people living in Mexico.
Yes, expatriates living in other countries. And I think like the generation maybe behind me, so my kids are in high school and eighth grade now, but the generation coming up with kids that are now in elementary school, those children of evangelicalism, many of them who are homeschooled themselves, they want to do things different than what their parents maybe did with them, but they're not exactly sure how. So I think we're offering an option for homeschoolers who don't want to engage with science maybe the way that it was presented to them as Christian kids in the church, but, you know, really feel like, well, just, you know, having a totally secular, whatever that means, perspective isn't going to serve their goals well either. So we are trying to give people tools that don't come with some of the sort of culture war baggage that you get from a lot of other Christian resources where everything kind of becomes politicized. We're just trying to say, here's the science, here's the Bible, the Christian thought that goes along with it. And, you know, you open up those spaces with your kids and emphasize the tradition or the values that are important to you as a Christian. We're not going to try to indoctrinate your children for you. Like, you have to teach them, but we're going to give you tools to do that well and thoughtfully and in interaction with what scholars are saying.
Good. So how are some of these diverse groups responding to what Integrate has produced so far? It's okay to brag a little bit here.
Yeah. Our pilot teachers have been really positive. We've gotten really good feedback. We've also made a lot of changes based on the feedback. So we're constantly trying to improve it to meet the needs of the classroom teachers and the homeschool teachers a little better. And they have really, what people appreciate is what they keep saying is we have such good conversations when we use this. It really helps me draw out what my teenagers, what my students are thinking, and really helps them like put their thoughts into more solid form and communicate where their tensions are. And I think that with young people today, one of the criticisms that they have of the church is that there just isn't space for processing questions. There isn't space for having doubts. There isn't space for like figuring out your own identity and how you fit in. And so
I've seen that point correlated specifically to people who grew up in the church, but then left the faith because they said they never had a chance to ask those kind of questions. So if this does nothing but provide those kind of spaces, I'd say that's a pretty huge win.
Yes. Yes. And we are trying to do more asking of good questions and presenting options for beginning a path toward an answer than presenting answers. And I know that's scary for some people because like we do want to point our young people towards answers. We don't want to just leave them with questions and whatever, tear down everything they think and not give them tools to build something in its place. So we are pointing towards answers, but we're not trying to say like, we have everything all figured out and here's what you need to think, kids. And I think that's what a lot of people are responding to very positively is just the chance, even like a lot of adults didn't think about these things in their own education. And it's good for them to have the resource and the chance to process and understand like a good, solid scientific foundation that they're actually dealing with real facts. And then they're processing them in light of what our historical Christian teachings have been, what our values are. I think, too, a lot of times we get caught up in this idea of, well, there's a Bible verse for everything. And that's the important part. And not that the point of the Bible is to shape us and form us into the kinds of Christians we're supposed to be. So we've tried to incorporate the Bible into the curriculum less in terms of, well, you know, we're talking about genetic testing, what Bible verse could possibly relate, and more be like, the Bible has a lot to say about wisdom, and we need wisdom in deciding how to use these technologies. So how can we really internalize what the Bible teaches us about being wise people and then apply wisdom to this question? And I really think that focus is appreciated by the people who've kind of been burned out on this idea that, you know, incorporating the Bible or integrating faith means providing a proof text for your position.
Yeah. Well, there's one more topic that's kind of related to this, to teaching your kids at home. There's one more topic that I wanted to talk to you about, which is one that whether you homeschool or not, all parents face at some time. And that's how to talk to kids about issues related to origins. And you wrote an article for the Biologos website a few months ago about this, drawing from your own experience, giving some general do's and don'ts. And I think it's really helpful. We'll link to that in the show notes. But I'd like to probe it a little bit more here, but my kids are grown, and I'm afraid whatever I did with them, the damage is already done. Like your mom saying to you, I must have scarred them somehow. But Colin is in the thick of this right now at his house, so let's pull him out from behind the controls and get him in on this conversation. Colin, are you here?
I'm here. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
So my kids are currently 3 years old and 4 months, and my four-month-old hasn't started asking really hard questions yet. But recently, my three-year-old has clearly been trying to comprehend God. And one of the things I've learned from my time at Biologos is that hard questions often deserve a lot of nuance. But there's times when a three-year-old is just looking for a simple answer. Are there some points at which it's appropriate or necessary to give answers that might not be correct only because it's too simple?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it relates not only to God, but with everything with kids. You know, how you have to really listen to the question they're asking and not give them more answer than they're actually asking for. And so, One way I thought about it, my analogy is like when your 3 year old asks you how babies are made, like they don't need a lecture about the intricacies and nuances of human sexuality and, you know, how the current situation is destroying the institution of marriage. You know, they just need to know that babies grow in mommy's tummies, like something like that. And so I think if you kind of like think of that parallel, that we teach kids about reproduction in stages, and we answer the questions as they understand things and as they become curious and as they need to know. And origins is the same thing. Like for me, I mean, I had the children's Bibles, and you read the stories about the 6 days of creation, and they're presented in a very straightforward manner. And so sometimes people would talk to me and they're like, well, do you explain to your four-year-old that it wasn't really maybe 7 days? And I say, no, you just tell the story. That's what you're reading. They aren't asking about evolutionary history and how it fits in with the 6 days of creation. So just like, let the story speak. And I think that, one thing I was kind of convicted on, and it was actually came up in one of the podcasts you did earlier with Alistair McGrath. He was talking about narrative apologetics, I think he called it, and how we often feel the need, instead of telling the story, to explain the story. And I think, especially with children, like sometimes we just need to tell the story and leave the explaining to when they ask for explanations. So, I just recommend to people, you know, when you read the Bible, read the Bible and delight in its truth, the way you delight in the relationship with the God it's revealing. You know, so when I would read Genesis in the children's Bible with my kids, we'd think about, oh, isn't it amazing that God created all these beautiful things? Let's go look at something beautiful. Isn't it amazing that God created all this food that tastes so good? Let's really enjoy this juicy grape, and just trying to say, like, how do we teach our kids to be worshipers and to be grateful people who dwell in a creation that's good? And they don't, like, that's the kind of instruction I think that their souls need in that kind of concrete phase that they're in. And then later, you know, as they start asking questions about other things, you can bring up the more detailed things.
Yeah, so here's an example that's maybe less about biblical interpretation and more theological. But the other night, my son, Micah, asked my wife in bed, do you know God? And I've been thinking a lot about how I would answer that, because I worry that simply just saying, yeah, I know God, makes him maybe think that God is some guy that we meet with in secret and keep away. Because isn't that what Micah thinks when we say, I know this person? And I'm not sure how to say what kind of a relationship that is in ways that would make sense to him and be at least approximately correct.
Yeah, I would say we need to give kids more credit for what they're able to imagine. And so I think, yeah, you should say, yeah, I know God and God knows me. And then how do you know? You'd have to draw on your own experience. Like, where do you feel you meet God? Where do you feel you experience God? And I think sharing those kind of things about how we experience God in our own lives, like when we worship through a song or when we see something outside, or like, I think different people have different ways of connecting to God, and sharing those spiritual experiences with our kids is something that can give their own imaginations and their own kind of growing ability to relate to God as a person, something to sort of aspire to. But I was always amazed talking to my own kids how they have their own experiences with God. I like, God loves kids. Jesus loved the little children, you know. And so I think when you communicate to them that God is real and his love is real and his protection is real and his care for us each day is real, they internalize that so concretely and they experience it themselves. And so, I think the more we can share about our, you know, what's true about our relationship with God, the better off our kids are and just seeing it lived out.
What stage are you at with your kids now in having these kind of conversations? When does it cross the threshold into not just telling stories, but trying to explain stories?
Well, yeah, I feel like I'm at the best part because my kids are now 16, 14, and 13. And so especially the older ones, you know, I can give them a book that I think is interesting and say, hey, read it. Let's talk about it. And they are able to engage with, you know, adult-like thought on any number of issues. And I think what we spend a lot of time talking about is not so much their personal questions and processing, but this idea of how other people are thinking differently and how do you have conversations with your friends or your teachers or your just peers about some of these topics where, because my kids spend a lot of time in communities that are probably like more of the young earth, conservative, evangelical communities than they spend like with public school students. So they feel alone sometimes in their perspectives. And so it's good for them to sort of process through, okay, this is what I think, but how do I explain it to somebody else? Or how do I understand how they see it differently? And so we have a lot of those kind of conversations.
We hear a lot from young people who have been maybe kind of enamored with the simple, tidy answers that they've gotten, maybe from those kinds of communities. Any tips on how to raise our kids so that they are the kind of people who will do the kind of searching that is maybe messy and hard, but has a lot of fullness that comes out of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone is different and people have a different like tolerance for ambiguity. And I am like a very high ambiguity tolerant person. So probably my kids are frustrated with me in that I very rarely like have answers for them. And I'm always like, oh, that's such a good question. Let's think about that for a while. Oh, I wonder, you know what that makes me think of? This other question. And so I don't know that my children come to me for answers ever. But I also think that we have to be careful not to assume that our kids' questions are going to be the same as our questions. If we grew up in one kind of framework and we're raising our kids in a different one, then the questions they have are going to be different. So I've really had to listen hard sometimes when my kids are asking me things, because I hear the question I would have asked coming from a totally different place. And I'm not really listening to what they're actually asking because they're coming from a different place where a lot of the assumptions have never been what my assumptions were. So, yeah, I think just it doesn't scar your children to say, I don't know, or that's a really good question. I wonder the same thing. Or, what are you going to do with that question? And just keep the conversation going and just kind of release yourself from this idea that parents have to have answers. Like, we don't. The kids, they do okay if you don't give them answers. They figure stuff out.
Well, to keep a theme going in my questions, what's been the biggest challenge and the most rewarding aspect of homeschooling your kids?
I feel like because you spend so much time with them, you end up with so many shared experiences that you can draw on in your relationship. So one of the things I hear from friends of mine who don't homeschool is like, oh, I hardly even see my kids these days. And sometimes I, wish I saw my kids less, but we have so much common ground. We've read so many books together and cried over the dogs that died. And we have, so many different places we've gone together and learned things. And we just have a lot of, just shared history that then makes us feel closer as people. And they, for them too, as siblings, I think that they are closer than other siblings are just because they have done a lot of things together and they have so many of their inside jokes and so many of their, stories that they like to reminisce about together. And so I think that's been the biggest benefit is just kind of the bonding that happens when you have a shared life experience.
And the challenge?
Well, the challenge I think for me is because I didn't get into homeschooling because of sort of an ideological reason. I think if I was working in the United States, I probably would have sent my kids to school. But because of where we lived, it really was the only educational option. And I was a public school teacher. I have a lot of public school teachers in my family and I value education. And I don't think that the schools are all failing and doing a terrible job. I think they offer things sometimes that can't really be recreated in a homeschooling environment. So I think the challenge is just trying to make sure that like my kids actually get a good education and have the chance to have peers and have the chance to have like some healthy competition and kind of know where they stand in the world and not just have a super, super confined existence that's only like our home. And that's been harder, living cross-culturally and living, in a very rural area, but we're trying to make it happen. The internet's amazing for that.
Well, I think our time has passed. This has all been very interesting, but we need to send Colin back to the controls to edit this into an episode. Need to let you get back to homeschooling your kids and writing the Integrate curricula and translating the Bible and monitoring our forum. I hope nothing bad happened on the forum while you were gone and here with us.
But plenty of other playground monitors with whistles. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Thanks so much for talking, Christy.
Thanks, Christy.
Thank you very much.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the John Templeton Foundation, the Fetzer Institute, and by individual donors who contribute to BioLogos. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerwerf. That's me. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. The BioLogos offices are located in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the Grand River watershed, on the ancestral land of the Anishinaabe people. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find a link in the show notes for the BioLogos Forum, or visit our website, biologos.org, where you'll also find tons of articles, videos, and other resources on faith and science. Thanks for listening.